Understand what this county was like. This was a wild west. This was a wild place. Bootlegging, prostitution, gambling. The clubs was corrupt. The judicial system was corrupt. Everybody was on the take. Mafia was in and out of here. Liquor was coming in here in abundance.
In 1970, 18 of Rome's most prominent clergymen wrote an open letter to the sitting grand jury. It said, "Alarming allegations of widespread organized crime and corruption in governmental agencies in Rome and Floyd County have come to our attention. We urge you to instigate a thorough and complete investigation at the earliest possible moment. Specific allegations involving prostitution, including the development and use of juvenile prostitution, procuring, drug traffic, interstate white slavery, arson, and payoffs to law enforcement officials, require unstinting investigation and prosecution." The letter was in response to a boiling over scandal that involved alleged ties between the heads of Floyd County's criminal enterprises and the heads of Floyd County's judicial and governmental agencies, as well as the selective enforcement of the law and the selective unenforcement of the law for a fee. And that kind of corruption was bound to lead to violence. Life in Rome for a bootlegger was dangerous. I'd heard a lot from Gary, but I wanted to hear more about what life was like for other bootleggers in Rome back then. There aren't too many bootleggers left around these days, but some of their relatives are still there, and that's how I ended up talking to Charles Ledbetter about his father, Kelly Ledbetter.
He was a bootlegger. Everybody bootlegged back then. I was in high school, and, you know, I was sort of ashamed of it, but all the kids thought that was great, you know.
Charles used to work at the Floyd County Sheriff's Department, but after his retirement, he opened up a general store down in Cave Springs, just south of Rome. One day, while I was up in Floyd County, I stopped by his store to talk to him. And while we were talking, Charles called up Gail Godfrey to come by so I could hear from him as well. Gail's a long-term resident of Floyd County, and he's seen a lot.
At that time, there was no bonded liquor in Rome or Floyd County. Well, bonded liquor is made by the manufacturers, you know. And Kelly sold White Lightning. That was made in the woods back in those days.
Both types were illegal in Floyd County, so sometimes what bootleggers were carrying was liquor bought legally in other counties and illegally brought in, and sometimes what they were carrying was White Lightning, a.k.a. moonshine. Gail had never tried White Lightning himself, and he didn't know Kelly Ledbetter well, but he did remember the first time he'd ever met Kelly, back when he was a kid, maybe 11 or 12. He was with his older brother and his brother's friend, riding along the back seat, when they decided they wanted some liquor. So they went to Kelly Ledbetter's place.
And Kelly had a drive-in wonder to sell White Lightning out of. And I'd never heard of a drive-in wonder at that time. So they drove up there and to the wonder, and Kelly came to the wonder, and my brother told him he wanted a pound of liquor.
Kelly Ledbetter had a tank of White Lightning set up so that when the customer drove up, they'd give an order, he'd fill a jar up from the tap, money and moonshine would change hands, and away they'd go. But Kelly would move beyond selling whiskey out of the window of his house. He had a club that catered to Rome's upper classes, one where they could go to dinner and discreetly enjoy a whiskey on the rocks.
I heard your dad owned a place called the Chicken Club.
He did. It was a restaurant and bar. And actually, most of the people come to it were people from the sheriff's department, judges, lawyers, it's sort of like the only place in town, a couple places you could go get a steak and bring a bottle with you, and, you know, the brown bags, what they done.
It was these kind of clubs that Grace started working in before she opened her own beer joint.
So Grace had worked all these clubs back then before they voted liquor in. They had these private clubs, and she worked those. So she knew all these judges and stuff.
But these places where a judge could go at the end of the day after court left out to enjoy Manhattan or two, they weren't legal.
Again, this was a dry county for liquor, not beer. You had beer joints everywhere. You had five beer joints on one block on Broad Street.
And although for the most part, no one blinked an eye at the judges and the sheriff's deputies and the DAs regularly socializing together to enjoy prohibited substances, the hypocrisy wasn't lost on everyone. In 1968, the May term of the grand jury made a special presentment before Judge Robert Scoggin on the issue of the non-enforcement of liquor laws at private clubs in Floyd County. Quote, "It is our opinion for Floyd County to be a place where one wants to live, work, and raise a family. We must have a community of law and order, and to be a society of law, we must have respect for the law. This, of course, requires the uniform enforcement of all laws, so that the rich as well as the poor will know that if they violate the law, they will be prosecuted. No group, whether large or small, should be permitted to say which law will be enforced or which law will be violated. When this is done, every man soon feels that he is entitled to be the sole judge as to what is right and what is wrong. In this respect, we find that there has not been uniform enforcement of laws regulating the sale of alcoholic beverages. We do not say that this is the fault of any one person or group, but that it is the fault of the entire community. By failing to enforce the law properly, we are contributing to a breakdown in law and order. If the majority of our citizens are not in favor of the present liquor laws, they should be changed, and this can be done in a constitutional way. But unless they are changed, all laws should be enforced, and we do hereby call upon not only the law officials to do so, but we call upon all of our citizens to refrain from violating the law." In other words, as enforced in Floyd County, the law, in all of its majestic quality, forbade the rich and the poor alike from drinking liquor anywhere that was not a private club. This kind of casual corruption was only the start of it, though. Remember those complaints about prostitutes in the clergyman's letter? Well, it's not much of a mystery what that was referring to.
Well, they had a house of ill repute.
Peggy's? I have heard all about Peggy's.
All the judges and all got to go up there, and Mabel's. And they were known worldwide.
Mabel's and Peggy's were Rome's houses of lesser repute, but of the two, Peggy's was the real attraction. And by the way, Charles really wasn't exaggerating what he said about Peggy's being known around the world. I think for a certain generation of Romans, their favorite travel story is about that time they went to some far-flung location, and when they mentioned to the locals that they were from Rome, Georgia, the response would be, "Oh, I hear Peggy's is nice." And if you're wondering about how a nice little southern town that still outlawed liquor could also openly have brothels that were known to all the church-going folk and yet still coexisted more or less peacefully in the community, well, the answer is simple. Peggy kept the judges and police well paid. And while they probably didn't pay as well as Peggy's did, Rome's other less than legal establishments were all paying too.
So a lot of people mentioned to me that back in the day, it was understood that if you were, you know, had a beer joint or had a bar, you were given a cut to the local police and local judges. And that's just kind of how it was.
I would say that's right.
It seems like everyone knew it. It wasn't really a secret.
Right. I guess what they were doing was asking for a little protection of their business.
The protection money wasn't an issue so much for the beer joints that were actually just beer joints, but in places where White Lightning was an offer or other activities took place, or if you're transporting the stuff in or doing anything else that the law technically forbade, then when you were counting in your profits, yeah, you better make sure the justice system was getting its own cut.
Anyway, it was corrupt. The law was on, a lot of the police were on the take. Everybody was making money.
And sure, even if you were paying tribute, you were still going to get raided once in a while. But you'd also get a friendly phone call the night before to let you know that the law enforcement would be by for a chat the next day.
So every now and then they'd have to raid just to make it look good, you know. So she'd get a call. "You're going to get raided." So here we go, start hiding stuff and all that stuff. So they were on the take.
Most of the old-timers I spoke to wouldn't go on the record even now. But retired law enforcement and retired lawbreakers alike all told me the same thing. Rome had been a tough and crooked little town, and the law and the bootleggers were often closer than they were far apart. And bootleggers were far from the worst of it. There were some serious criminals in town, people that were, as I was told, not to be trifled with under any circumstances. As one person put it, give them a couple $100s and someone would be gone. And as for the police and the courts, well, it cost you a bit more than that, but if you found yourself in jail, they could get you out, or could make sure that you never went to jail in the first place. It was kind of a symbiotic relationship, or maybe mutually parasitic is a better term for it. And sure, some of the county and city officials were good folks, but on the whole, I was told, it'd been more crooked than it was straight. And even of the good folks, sometimes they were on the take too.
What do you know about the sheriff at that back then by the name of Joe Adams? Joe Adams was, he turned his head on a lot of stuff. But in another way, he was a good man. He went to the bootlegger and put
What I was telling you about my dad.
Put some money in my hand.
And buy Christmas stuff for poor people. Give it out.
He never kept the money for himself. He went and bought groceries for the car loads.
And my dad loved them.
So it's kind of a social tax.
Yeah. But deep down inside, Joe Adams was a good man. But he took money from the bootleggers and went and bought stuff and they carried it to needy families and all. Which I guess back at that time was pretty good because there were a lot of people hurting, you know.
Sheriff Joe Adams was apparently kind of like the Robin Hood of crooked cops. But those government officials on the take weren't always so generous.
There was a judge here. His name was Bob Scoggins. If you operated here illegal and you didn't pay tribute to him, you wouldn't last long. So everybody that was in big business paid tribute. I mean, they major bootleggers and stuff, they pay offs.
With law enforcement being paid to look the other way and going to their private clubs to enjoy the contraband whiskey that was prohibited to everyone else, it's no surprise that even a small Georgia town like Rome would become a hotbed of violence.
Now, you know, the environment in Rome was all the beer joints, and I told you, I named all those to you. So the lifestyle around here, it was just rough and tumble. Now I know there are other people who lived here that didn't get in trouble like I did, but it was a rough place to live. There was a lot of shootings going on.
And for a bootlegger, life in Rome could be dangerous.
Yeah, he was a good man. My father was. I always thought of him as being the old when he died, but 46 years old is not old when you get to my age.
It's old when you're 19.
Yeah. There's a lot of speculation about who done it, you know, and I think I know who done it, but I'm not going to say that name because...
What I've heard is that your dad got in some kind of trouble not too long before his death, and that he'd made comments that he might talk.
Well, yeah. He was going before the grand jury to talk, to tell them what he knew about something, and he never made it to the grand jury.
Kelly Ledbetter was assassinated on February 25th, 1968. An unknown assailant, who'd been laying in wait from a distance, shot him once with a high-powered rifle as he was leaving his club one night and getting into his truck. His murder went unsolved, but his obituary hints at some of the strange social structures that were in place in Rome at the time. Kelly Ledbetter had been a bootlegger, although he had other business interests too. At the time of his death, he did have pending charges for bootlegging. But he was also a respected citizen, and Rome's most important law enforcement and judicial officials turned out for his funeral. His obituary read, "An honorary escort will be composed of by Judge Robert L. Scoggin, Sheriff Joe Adams, and then a list of 13 other names. I don't recognize all of them, but at least four of them were police officers with Rome and Floyd County. And both the sheriff and the chief judge of Floyd County were counted as close personal friends of the assassinated bootlegger."
Science tells us that there are 5 stages of sleep, but before you can enter any of them, you need to be comfortable so you can fall asleep. And believe me, I know. I have spent a lifetime tossing and turning, trying to get comfortable enough to go to sleep quickly. That is, until I got Bowl & Branch sheets, the most comfortable sheets you will ever sleep on. What makes them unique is that each sheet is crafted from 100% organic cotton. That means Bowl & Branch sheets not only feel incredible, but they also look amazing. And because they sell exclusively online, you don't have to pay that expensive retail markup. That's half the price for twice the quality. You will love these sheets, and you can try them for 30 nights and see for yourself. If you're not impressed, return them for a full refund. They are soft, luxurious, comfortable. They come beautifully, impeccably packaged. They make a great gift, by the way. And anyone who sleeps on them loves them. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews. The New York Times, Forbes, and the Wall Street Journal rave about them. And even three U.S. presidents, guess what? They have Boll & Branch sheets. So go to BollandBranch.com today, and you'll get $50 off your first set of sheets, plus free shipping in the U.S. when you use the promo code UNDISCLOSED. That's $50 off, plus free U.S. shipping right now at BollandBranch.com. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code undisclosed. BollandBranch.com. Again, that's the promo code undisclosed. Try out their sheets today. You will not regret it.
We played a dangerous game. And we lived a hard, fast, rough life. And I had people, I remember the first gun I bought was for protection. I never bought a gun to want to kill anybody with. But I did have a guy pull a knife and hold it at my throat for a long way. So I'll have to tell you about that just another time. And after that, I bought a gun.
Gary had his own share of close calls during his bootlegging career, but at the beginning, it hadn't seemed like there was much danger to it. He'd gotten an early start in the business thanks to his older brothers. He was the youngest of six children, but his next youngest brother was already 14 by the time he came along, which means he had lots of older siblings to show him the ropes of the trade.
But I was driving a car when I was about 8-10 years old. They would take me out, my brothers, and on country roads, and I learned to drive car with straight shift on the collar, so I could drive good. By the time I was 10, 12 years old, I could handle a car pretty good. Back then, you had a lot of dirt roads out there, and sometimes you might get in a chase, a little bit of a chase, and if you, the key was knowing the roads, knowing the outs, and getting on those dirt roads, it's stirring up some dust, and you could pretty well get by. That's pretty well how I got started in it.
His training as a bootlegger may not have begun until he was 8, but his training as a beer joint operator had come earlier. When he was little, his parents had gone through some health issues, and they'd sent him to live with Cousin Flick for a while. And since Cousin Flick ran a beer joint, Gary became an apprentice beer joint operator.
Flick is where I learned. After him and Estelle divorced, I'd stay with him at night, and we'd play five-card draw, seven-card stud. He taught me how to play cards, how to gamble, and he would give me beer, and we'd go in and open up the beer joint. And back then, they had the long-neck bottles, what we call the long-neck bottles, it was returnable. And you go in and you pop one of those Budweiser, Blue Ribbons, and that was breakfast.
How old were you?
Somewhere maybe 6-7 years old. He wouldn't give me a lot, but he'd let me, you know, he'd say, okay, you can have a little bit of it.
When he tells these stories, Gary is protective of his parents, reluctant to acknowledge that the conditions of his childhood that he was raised in were, to put it mildly, not necessarily ideal.
Well, again, that's why I wanted to explain about my parents was that they had worked hard all their lives, had raised this family, and then having me at that age, they were just so tired. We never lacked. I guess we were some of those people that were poor, but we didn't know it. It didn't take much back then.
And to get a little pocket money, Gary found his own ways to get by.
I started trying to work when I was just a little kid. And one thing is my dad would come in from work, and he wore overalls, and he worked in the card room at the cotton mill. We'd have lint just all over him, and I'd have to help him wash his back. And I remember looking at that when I was a kid, and my God, this man works hard. So I never wanted to take from them. I wanted to give to them. and I could always hustle a buck. If I could make enough money to go to the movies, I'd walk and I'd spend the day at the DeSoto Theater. Sometimes I'd go on to the First Avenue Theater and walk home that night.
How old were you?
Then I was probably 10, 11, somewhere like that.
So he was an entrepreneur from an early age. Even the local fair coming to town was a chance to make some money.
I would park cars in my yard and charge them a whole lot less than what they had to pay at the fair. So once I got my yard, I filled the yard up with cars and couldn't get any more in. I'd close. And then I had a hole that I could go under the fence and come out in the cattle barn at the fairground. So then I'd go over there and spend my money.
It's not that Gary didn't have a happy childhood. He did. It's just there really wasn't hardly any of it.
At that time, you're looking for your niche. First of all, I'm growing up too fast. That wonderful childhood, Davy Crockett days, fairground days, that all pretty well ended by the time I was 12. That was gone. Those days was gone.
Did you stay in school?
No. No, me and the guys, we went to junior high for a while. When you are driving cars in different places and you can get in the joints, it was kind of hard to go back to school and pledge allegiance. And I was already in a different world.
At 15, Gary's first son was born, and within a few years, he and his first wife had 3 children together, though they split up not long after that. But Gary was providing for all of them, and when you're trying to take care of a growing family while you're still in your teens and without a high school education, a career as a bootlegger made an enticing option. Gary's brothers had put him in touch with people who could use his skills in driving the back roads, and he could make good money that way. And also, it was maybe a lot of fun.
My son was born on December the 23rd, 1963. I ended up coming back to Rome. And then I started working for, I want to name some names. You did. It was Dink Causey. And Dink was real connected. He furnished a lot of the bootleggers. There were a lot of ways to make money when making liquor besides just making the liquor. They started hauling sugar because they made it harder to make from the corn. So to make it faster, sugar was used. So you had 100-pound bags of sugar that would be delivered to different places. Then you had the jugs, all the makings that went into making whiskey. He furnished the supplies.
Living the way he was, Gary was much older than his actual years. And that's literally true, at least as far as the government was concerned.
I upped my age. In fact, I got a picture of the driving license where it shows I was born in 1944. I got those driving licenses. I'll show it to you in a minute. But I was born in 48.
In order to get by doing some of the things he was doing, he changed his birth year to reflect that he was 4 years older than he really was. So when he was 14 years old, he had the government ID of an 18-year-old, and the rest of the world thought he was 18 as well. When they eventually met in late 1968 or early 1969, Grace was actually 11 years older than Gary, a fact that she never knew, as at that time, Gary was still going by his fake birth date of 1944. But you can see in the news articles reporting on Grace's murder that Gary Reeves, age 30, was arrested. In reality, he was only 26 at the time. But even before he got with Grace, Gary's life as a bootlegger had expanded beyond the Floyd County backroads to the interstate highways.
So, running liquor with Dink, I graduated from this level of liquor to running liquor to Detroit. That's when I realized the first trip I made to Detroit, my brother Doyle ran a U-Haul place in Marietta. We got a U-Haul truck from him, and we go to Dayton, Tennessee, and we load the truck with liquor. It was snowing. There was a blizzard going on. And when you got 2 gallons of liquor in each hand, and you're trying to get down a trail that's snow and get it in the back of a truck, well, it was hard work. Fast money, hard work, dangerous. So when we got into Detroit, this Cadillac pulls up with shotguns and guns, and they lead us to a warehouse by the Canadian border, and we unload the liquor there. Now, that's a big difference from delivering a couple of gallons to a house out in the country somewhere to there. So I knew then, hey, this is big time here.
And after a while, Dink was using Gary for other jobs besides just hauling liquor.
Time went on. This kind of thing went on for a good while. We did a lot of this. Then one day he says, "Ride, you want to ride? Ride with me down to Easton Hill." Well, we go to Easton Hill, and there's a load of guns that had been stolen, an inside job, and it was done by policemen. And this is what we did. Merchandise would come in where they would hijack a truck or a train, a boxcar, and steal all the merchandise off of it and take it to a place. Then we would go and get it and sell it to different. We had sources where we could unload this stuff everywhere. Now, I'm telling you all this, and then when people hear this, they're going to say, well, this guy should have been in prison a long time ago. Well, yeah, but not for what I got put in there for.
I am juggling a lot lately. I've got a little infant, 4 months old, I've got work, I've got family, I'm traveling, and the last thing I need to do is to spend any of my precious time standing in line at the post office, because believe me, I do not have the time, energy, or the patience for that, and I'm sure many of you don't either. Well, you can avoid the hassle of the post office and mail everything from postcards to envelopes to packages, domestic or international, using stamps.com, and you can create your stamps account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. Unlike the post office, stamps.com never closes. Print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. And believe me, sometimes in the middle of the night, after feeding that baby, that's exactly what I'm doing. Stamps is convenient, easy, reliable, and flexible. Stamps.com makes it easy. They will send you a digital scale, which automatically calculates your exact postage. You're not even wasting any money on postage. And they will even help you decide the best class of mail based on your needs. I use Stamps.com because I don't have the time to waste at the post office, and I know most of you don't either. So right now, you can enjoy Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitment. Here's how you get it. You go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's Stamps.com. Enter undisclosed. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again.
On the day Dink and Gary picked up the guns in Easton Hill, one of the firearms they got was a high-powered rifle, and Dink had a special delivery to make.
So we come back to Rome. We come in with these loaded guns. But first place we go is Judge Robert L. Scoggins, Bob Scoggins. We go to his place. He comes outside. He sees me. And I knew him, but I had not had any dealings with him. Dink's mother, who was a bootlegger, she paid for protection through him. So we deliver the gun to Scoggins. And I remember him looking at me. He didn't look like he liked that I was there, and I didn't feel too comfortable with it myself. But I trusted Dink. So we left there, and I just remember Dink saying something about there'll be a dead bootlegger in a few days.
Gary has no knowledge of what happened next, or how Dink knew what he knew, or whether Dink really knew what was to come. But Dink was right. Not long after that, Charles Ledbetter came home to find a police officer waiting for him.
I think I was gone on a date. I come in and a friend of ours, policeman, was at my house and told me I needed to go with him. I had no idea what was wrong, and he carried me to the hospital. My dad was at the hospital. He died instantly, you know, but I didn't know that at the time. But he run the Moose Lodge on Shore Avenue across the street on Division Street from the Crystal. Mm-hmm. He had come out of the building to get in his truck, and somebody shot through the windshield and shot him in the head.
Initially, the police had some leads to follow, but most of them just didn't shake out. And although they had all kinds of rumors to look into and all kinds of ideas as to who might have wanted to kill Kelly Ledbetter, the investigation went cold.
No, my mother spent every penny she had on private detectives trying to find out who killed him. But
over the next decade or so, a couple attempts were made to reopen the case. As reported in an August 1970 article in the Rome News Tribune, reliable investigative sources have told the News Tribune that they are exploring new leads in the ambush sling of convicted bootlegger Kelly Ledbetter, which has gone unsolved for 2 years. The newest lead on investigation is that Ledbetter's death may have somehow been connected to a charge of possessing and transporting tax-paid liquor, which was pending at the time he was slain. One of Ledbetter's brothers said that he was told by the GBI, "You're going to be awfully surprised when you find out who did it." The article went on to say, an alleged procurer told the News Tribune that Ledbetter was pressuring the wrong man. The procurer said that he would deny having made the statement if questioned by law enforcement. The investigators, who have been probing allegations of vice and crime in connection with Roman Floyd County, indicated that they suspect a conspiracy in the slaying. Then, in 1976, the judge who had taken Judge Scoggin's seat after defeating him in the 1974 election tried to reopen the Kelly Ledbetter case once more. Judge Frazier charged the grand jury to look into the case again to see whether it warranted reopening. He told them, "I know that you are as concerned as I am to see that matters such as these are fully investigated and that those criminally responsible are brought to justice. I therefore direct that you investigate these cases and determine what further action might be taken to see that they are brought to a proper conclusion. Ladies and gentlemen, go to your task and investigate this and all other matters which you feel are proper. Do not be afraid to investigate any matter which you feel should be investigated, regardless of the persons involved or the institutions concerned. Good government begins with you. If you do your job, and I know you will, then this will be a good first step towards better government." Judge Frazier continued, "Throughout this investigation, rumors have appeared regarding this case. More specifically, I have heard it said that the local police have solved the murder, but are unable to proceed in their investigation." As reported in a 1976 article on these efforts to reopen the case, reliable sources have told the broadside that a Rome police detective has a report that alleges the motive of the Ledbetter murder, the person who ordered it, and the murderer himself. But no one has ever been charged in the murder. Ledbetter was killed a month after he was arrested by county police on a charge of possession and transporting tax-paid liquor. He was expected to be convicted and given a prison sentence. Some observers believe that Ledbetter was going to go before a grand jury and to give information that might have linked other persons to crimes in the county. There was an implication last April in the habeas corpus hearing of a self-proclaimed fixed man of Floyd County, Hugh Don Smith, that Ledbetter was killed to shut him up. Smith at the time said that the former Judge Scoggin, quote, "has partial facts on a couple killings in this county." Smith alleged that Scoggin worked with him in a bribery system that let probationers free for a fee. The judge has denied the charges. None of this went anywhere, though. The grand jury would decline Judge Frazier's recommendation that it investigate the case, and no further action was taken to solve Ledbetter's murder. Charles Ledbetter, Kelly Ledbetter's son, thought that maybe what he needed to solve his father's murder was a man on the inside.
Even when I went to work for the sheriff's department, I tried to find out about my daddy's. One of the main reasons that I went, but all the records had disappeared, so.
But at the time Charles Ledbetter joined the sheriff's department, there should have been a file there still. There should have been something.
you're not supposed to throw cash that's not been closed yet in no way, but...
But, as Gail Godfrey noted, the police records back then had a bad habit of growing legs.
Seemed like in those days there wasn't as much security with those files as there should have been.
They were just gone. Even after becoming law enforcement himself, there was nothing Charles Ledbetter could do to make those records exist again.
You guys tried for a long time to try and investigate?
I did on my own, but I had got up to CAP, but then I could get access to some of the files, but you can't get access to something that's not there. You know, it's gone.
Unfortunately, just like the records in the Kelly Ledbetter case, the records from Grace's murder have disappeared decades ago. Gary tried before to get them, back in the 90s, but nothing could be done. Rome Police Chief Hubert Smith tried to help Gary back then to track them down. But, like Charles Ledbetter said, you can't find what's not there.
Hello.
Chief, just want to touch base with you. I sent you a letter about my records.
Yeah, I gave it to Marshall.
Okay, I know y'all don't have those records that they were missing, but I just need it in writing that they're not, that they are missing, and just documented, a letter.
Yeah, we never could find those.
Well, they're missing from the DA's office as well.
Yeah, and records retention don't have them either.
Yeah, they're missing from the archives.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
I don't know either about that.
It's kind of strange that, you know, they disappeared in all three places.
Didn't they have another thing up there? You said that they had a little case on you before, and they had that, didn't they?
They had that, yeah. But the other stuff was gone.
It's hard not to wonder how many case files Rome and Floyd County have lost over the years, and it makes me thankful that at least most of the Joey Watkins case was still there to be found, even if some crucial pieces were missing. Because according to an ex-police officer with the Rome Police Department who called up Gary after seeing him on TV, a case that might turn awkward for the city of Rome or Floyd County is likely to turn to a case file you'll never see again. In fact, there was one case that was still haunting him, a guy who had been sentenced to prison for kidnapping and rape, but for years had kept writing, proclaiming his innocence. Finally, the former officer had decided to take a look at the file, just to figure out why this rapist and kidnapper kept saying he was innocent. And when he did, what he saw convinced him that something had gone horribly wrong, that the case file didn't look right, and the guy looked like he really might have been innocent. But when the ex-officer tried to do something about it, he was told to keep his mouth shut.
I was told in no uncertain terms, now this is the exact words, that there was a witness involved that testified against the man in prison. And I had me a photo, a lineup made with photos, and I had both men in there, and they did favor some. But I wanted to go back and redo the whole case, do a new lineup and everything. And I was told in no uncertain terms that they were not going to upset a citizen of Rome that had testified against a person, and that I would get out of it safe.
Really?
Yeah. I wasn't the district attorney with it anyway, even after I was told that.
The case never did get reopened, as far as the officer knew. He left the force, and there was no way to ever get access to that case file again.
When I left, there were still some things that were iffy, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I was told that as far as ever getting my hands on another case file or seeing another case file, I'd never be allowed to do it as long as I could prevent it.
In Gary's case, the loss of that police file is brutal in terms of giving us a chance to reconstruct what really happened that night. The police didn't do much investigation, but they did do some, and because that file is missing, there are at least two big things in Gary's case that I'm not sure we'll ever be able to know the answer to. The first is how many shots were fired, and the second is who tracked the bloody footprints through the house. The number of shots we'll get into later, because there's at least a little bit to go on there. A little. But the bloody footprints, well, they can't really be more than a side note in this case due to the loss of the police file. But if we had known everything about them, they could have been huge. Unfortunately, the only reason we even know they exist is because when Charlotte was interviewed in the summer of 75, she mentioned them.
I was sitting on the living room floor, and I just happened to go down beside me, and there was some footprints on the carpet in the living room. And it wasn't a very clear print. It looked like just somebody had walked through some blood or something. and it was on the carpet. And it was rather a large footprint, you know. You couldn't see the whole front there, but you could sort of see the front of the foot and the back, like the heel. And so I went into the bedroom and I got one of Gary's shoes. And it was a much larger footprint than Gary's shoes.
This never came up at trial, and it's not in any records I've seen other than here. But according to Charlotte, there were footprints and blood somewhere in that house on Maple Street after Grace was killed. Charlotte saw them, and the police were interested in them too. So interested that they even had Charlotte pull out Gary's shoes so they could try to see if it was a match. Only it wasn't. The bloody footprints were too big to have come from Gary, and while I don't know this for a fact, I guess, I think it's okay to assume that also means that they were too big to come from Charlotte or Beverly. Beverly recalls the footprints too. She says they were going back into one of the bedrooms, but whether it was Grace and Gary's bedroom or Bo and Charlotte's bedroom, she couldn't remember now. Charlotte, in her interview back in 75, just said that they were on the carpet somewhere. So, outside of the kitchen anyway, but that doesn't help to clarify if they were heading back into a bedroom like Beverly says. But if the footprints were too big to be Gary's, whose were they? And the fact the cops had Charlotte compare Gary's shoes to them suggests to me, at least, that the cops had ruled out themselves as being the source. It seems like they had reason to believe that the prints weren't left by anyone who had a good reason to be at the crime scene. But without a case file to give some kind of additional information, the bloody footprints are a dead end. Which leaves me wondering, what if there are other problems with the crime scene that Grace or Beverly never mentioned, so we have no way of knowing about now? Like, say, the bullet trajectory. Let alone how many bullets there were, where were they coming from? Did the police ever check into that at all? Probably not, given that there was no real investigation, but I wish now we had some way of figuring out something as basic as that.
Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers all across the U.S. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of each ingredient required for a recipe, they're reducing food waste. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. And what I can say is not only are Blue Apron meals easy to prepare, they've also given me ideas for my own home cooking and made me a better cook overall. Some of the upcoming meals from Blue Apron I'm looking forward to are the creamy shrimp rolls with quick pickles and sweet potato wedges, and the fresh basil fettuccine pasta with sweet corn and Cuban bell pepper. And the great thing is that Blue Apron's freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. So now you can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
With the Rome police case files gone, we'll likely never know what happened to those bloody footprints or what happened to Kelly Ledbetter. But in the Ledbetter case, at least, there were other agencies involved in the investigation outside of the Rome Police Department, and I thought they might have their files still. Worth trying to track down, anyway. And even though it's not directly connected to the events on Maple Street on August 13, 1974, when Grace Reynolds was killed, I keep coming back to the Kelly Ledbetter case for the same reason I kept coming back to Gary's. Because, again and again, Gary's case and the corruption investigation of Judge Scoggin would keep overlapping in small and sometimes surprising ways. But beyond the direct ways in which it ended up touching on Gary's case, what happened with Kelly Ledbetter shows the odd and usually dark dynamics set into motion by Floyd County's liquor prohibitions. As it turned out, though, the GBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, still had their files on the case.
I've gotten the first round of documents I was looking for, but I do have some of the GBI file now.
Okay.
Have you ever seen that?
No, I haven't.
I'm curious, how many times do you think Judge Scoggin's name is mentioned in it?
Probably 100 times, I would imagine.
Zero.
You're kidding.
The GBI had investigated Ledbetter's death, and they had meticulously looked into rumor after rumor after rumor after rumor about some ne'er-do-well or another who might have done it or had a reason to do it, or someone said they heard that he did it. But then the case ended. The GBI shut it down in 73 without ever developing anything worth going off of. In their list of theories about the case, they got pretty creative, theorizing that the motive could have been anything from some kind of dispute over a truck, to a dispute with a business partner at the furniture store that he co-owned, or even that his death was due to his wife's involvement in some way. But my personal favorite was number 4 in their list of reasons that Kelly Ledbetter had been killed. And that's the dislike of Kelly Ledbetter by many persons who expressed their dislike for Kelly Ledbetter many times. But despite the GBI's intense focus on rumors about Kelly's death, never once did the GBI's original investigation so much as hint as what the newspaper articles and the talk around town were all hinting at themselves, that Kelly Ledbetter had been threatening to turn state's evidence against certain Floyd County officials shortly before he was assassinated. The murder of Kelly Ledbetter is very much unsolved today, and there's nothing tangible that exists now, nothing that I've seen that would constitute any real evidence against anyone. Gary does believe Scoggin was involved because, well, that's what Dink told him, and he'd been there when Dink handed over the high-powered rifle. And it wasn't long after that that sniper outside the Moose Lodge got Kelly. But Gary doesn't know anything for sure beyond what he saw, and there are plenty of other explanations for what could have happened to Kelly Ledbetter, as the GBI's list of theories shows. But Judge Scoggin should have been on the list of people who were questioned about it. Other people with far less in the way of rumors about them were investigated pretty thoroughly. One guy even got arrested. The guy wasn't charged, just arrested and held until they ran out of excuses to hold him. Yet, Scoggin's name never even shows up in the original GBI investigator's file. In 1970, the GBI did conduct a full-scale investigation into vice and bribe-taking in Floyd County, but since corruption isn't a violent crime, it's not a file the GBI still has today. And the prosecutions that arose from the investigation ended up falling apart, so we don't know what the vice investigations actually found. We do know, though, that a main target of the GBI's investigation was Judge Scoggin, and bribes that he was taking to fix cases and set bonds. But while we may not have any paper records today, Charles Ledbetter's friend, Gail Godfrey, served on a grand jury where Hugh Don Smith testified about the bribes that had been paid to judges for favorable legal outcomes. And according to him, Hugh Don Smith had more than the news articles at the time had let on.
Hugh Don was smarter than some of them thought he was. He had the goods on the judge. He had a check where he had paid for Bob Scoggin's television, where he'd had his carpet replaced in his house. He had checks of all that. They went and pulled that carpet up to see if it was the carpet that Hudon Smith said he paid for Bob Scoggin's house. Also the TV. And I remember the judge said it's a shame when they pull the judge's carpet up and check his TV. But and this was Hudon Smith testifying before the grand jury that I was on.
Asked me a question first time we met, or one of the times she was here. I was telling you about Dink getting the guns taken to Scoggins and all that, and you asked me how did that make me feel. Well, nobody ever asked me that I've ever, of course, I've never told that story to any reporters or anything, I don't think. I hope I didn't. At that time, what I remember is when we drove up and he came outside and he saw me, and I could tell that man was not happy that I was in that vehicle. But they kind of, I mean, he'd been paying tribute to Scoggins for years on anything that came in that he would get a load of furniture or a load of, where it be guns, where it be clothes, whatever it was, we fenced it. And he always gave Scoggins tribute. And he kind of, I guess, liked that, knowing he had a judge in his pocket. I didn't get into that. I mean, I wasn't that big time an operator. I just worked with him. But I remembered him looking at me, and I did have enough sense to realize after Dean told me what might happen, what was going to happen, I had enough sense back then, I didn't ask a lot of questions. And life was moving so fast, we went on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really think that much about it. But I'm going to tell you something. When I saw her, this daughter's picture in the paper, that bothered me. And I'm thinking, she was a child when that happened. Could I have done something to prevent that from happening? I don't think so. I think it would only got me killed sooner.
Yeah.
Myself.
I think Gary was probably right about that. If there's one thing I've learned from looking into this case, it's that in Northwest Georgia in the 1960s, life was often cheap. And I mean that quite literally. But while Gary had some close calls and made some enemies during his time as a bootlegger, as far as I can tell, none of those enemies were made for professional reasons. There were, however, at least two men who had personal reasons for wanting Gary dead, and nearly got him a few times.
I had Doyle Wade and another guy named Doyle. Both of them wanted to kill me.
Doyle Sharp?
Yeah. No, Doyle Sharp was a good friend. He was the one who told me that Doyle Wade, he believed Doyle Wade was planning to kill me. He had bought a pistol from him.
And yeah, I know, the number of Doyles involved in this case is ridiculous, especially since I'm not sure I've ever heard the name Doyle before meeting Gary, but just hang in there for now. Anyway, Doyle Wade was Grace's husband. That's why he wanted to kill Gary, even though Grace had left him before Gary ever entered the picture. The other Doyle, well, that was an older dispute, and Gary didn't want to get into the details of why exactly that Doyle wanted him dead out of respect for living family members of the people involved. But I'll just say that unlike Doyle Wade, it's pretty clear that the other Doyle had every right to be pissed at Gary. Still, other Doyle was the kind of guy whose reactions tended towards the excessive.
Now, this guy that was after me, he'd already killed his brother-in-law and shot another guy. This guy was a deadly little fellow.
And Gary had been a bootlegger since before he was out of grade school, so his life was never particularly safe, but after he met Grace, it seems as if his stories from that time become more reckless, more on the edge. And maybe that's why, when he remembers the times he had with Grace in the beer joints, it's usually Bad Moon Rising he remembers playing on the jukebox.
But when I met Grace, she was working at the 6 Mile, and I had heard about Grace. Can I tell you this? And I don't think I want to put that on the thing. She was known as Amazing Grace. I'm sorry. Well, I don't want to embarrass her. I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm talking bad about her, but she was known as Amazing Grace. And I walk in the 6 Mile, and she's waitressing, and her job is to play this jukebox playing and keep the pool tables going. And of course, I knew that. I've been in that business. And I knew who she was. And she told her my name, and she said, "I've heard about you." She said, "You're kind of a living legend." I might have been a legend in my own mind or something, but dadgum, we went together that night. That was it.
When I spoke to Beverly, she told me about how Grace and Gary had been like Bonnie and Clyde together. That's an exaggeration. Their life together wasn't really anything like that. But I can see how, to a 10 or 11-year-old, it might have seemed that way. And more than once, Gary and Grace stood side by side as they faced down possible death.
So Grace and I was out one time. We was at Gordon and Mary's. If you walk in the front door and you imagine kind of a horseshoe bar, and on one side you got tables, and on the other side you got tables. So Grace and I are over here in this corner. Well, this guy that I carried the wife to New York with pulls in. He comes in. And this has been a year or so later. He walks over to this table where these guys were on the other side of us. I thought it was about a dozen of them at the time, but in reality it was only 3 or 4 guys, but it looked like a dozen of them. I mean, man, he came in. I knew I had a problem. And they walk out to the trunk of his car. He opens the trunk of his car. And so the old boy running the place, he comes over to me and he says, "Man, they go shoot you when you try to go up to that front door. You got, I've, how many they were, let's say they were 4 or 5 of them. you got that many guns pointed at you right now. Well, Grace always carried a pocketbook, and I had a big 38 pistol that she kept in the pocketbook, and I had a small 38 pistol that I could keep on me. I don't know what made me think I needed the bigger gun. She's probably better shot than I was anyway. But anyway, I said, well, let's trade guns. And he said, so we get ready to stand up. And God bless his heart, Sergeant Glenn Harper, county policeman, walks in, walks straight to those guys, carries them outside door. This guy's just a raising king, telling he carried my wife off. He did all this. He comes back in and he says, y'all walk on out. And we walked out and got out of that one. And then the night down at the 6 Mile, we were there. We had a couple with us that was with us. We're at the booth. So we're down there and I'm going up to the jukebox and I'm probably playing Bad Moon Rising, I guess. I don't know, but I'm playing the jukebox. I turn around and crump the first adult had already made it to the bar. The second one, her husband, was walking in. Doyle Wade had a girlfriend named Peggy. She had called them. They had the beer joint, the Pines beer joint. They called them and said, told them I was there. So there they come. They're going to shoot me. Well, Tombert walks over to the table. I sat back down. Again, we swap guns. And this couple with us, they're just sitting there, man. I mean, they ain't really got nothing to do with this thing. And I'm trying to figure out, okay, how can we get them away from this if we're going to have to shoot out here? And James Tombert, he says, there's no way you're going to shoot your way out of this. He said, you're outgunned. There's more than those two. And he ran them out and made them leave. And again, we walked away. So that's a few times that Grace, I got to give it to her, man. She stood up with you. I mean, she ready to do battle. Can we pause?
They escaped shootouts those nights, but only because the whims of impulsive and violent men happened to fall in their favor. It could have easily gone the other way. And Doyle Wade was often a problem for Grace throughout the time Gary was with her. Doyle and Grace never did get divorced, and as far as Gary knows, they were never back together, but Doyle Wade had never stopped trying. And while all of these Doyles are confusing to keep up with now, apparently it was pretty confusing back then, too. In fact, a guy in Grace's place got shot once because of it.
Place is rocking and rolling tonight. It's full. Dink has come by. We were in the men's room splitting up some money on a deal we had done. I don't remember who it was. We'd made some money somehow. We were splitting the money up. And we hear a shot. And that place, it had one door. It cleaned out. It emptied out. Man, they were gone. I never seen anything empty. Well, nobody's standing there but me and him and Dink and Grace. And this guy points the gun at me. And it seems like it misfired. But Grace got between us, and she pushed him out the front door. I mean, she had guts with that. Which I found out later from a guy who knew this guy real well, that his plan was he wanted Grace.
Even the best laid plans can go awry, though, and this plan had one critical error. Because, see, Gene Bird, the shooter, was trying to shoot Doyle Wade, Grace's estranged husband. Gene Bird somehow thought that killing Grace's ex would help him get with Grace, but the guy in the bar that night, the one that was shot, was a guy named Doyle Minter. Different Doyle.
And this guy walked in, and somebody called his name. His name was Doyle. And he heard Doyle and shot him.
There are still two people alive, other than Gary, who witnessed the shooting. Gary called one of them up to see if he'd talk to me, but I guess old habits die hard. Even now, 48 years later, he wasn't going to risk getting mixed up in any kind of criminal investigation.
You didn't actually see the shooting. You heard the shot, and you came out and saw the guy laid on the floor. All right, would you just say that? This ain't got nothing to do with court or nothing. We're not talking about nothing.
But the other one still around is the guy who got shot, Doyle Minter. He survived and he's still around today, and he hasn't forgotten the night a guy walked up and shot him in the chest with no warning.
Yeah, that's been 50 years ago, so it's kind of... But a guy just thought I was somebody else and walked up and shot me. And there was another guy that got the same first name I did. I think he was trying to get in. Of course, I was lucky and blessed, I guess you could say. It just hit my rib and went around the rib and stuck out my back a little bit, but... We were shooting hoops, me and a couple of guys that I went down there with. And I was sitting there and getting ready for my next shot. And he just walked up and shot me. He didn't say a word, nothing. He thought I was another person, is what he told the police. The detective that worked the case, he thought I was Doyle Wade.
Anyway, that guy that got his Doyles mixed up, that wasn't his first shooting. He had this magazine he liked to show people to prove it.
His name was Gene Bird. He had killed a guy in California, and there was a story about it in one of those detective magazines. He had confessed to the murder, had his picture and everything, confessed to the murder, but they could never find the body.
Gary has it mostly right. Gene Bird did get convicted of the killing, but he also made a deal with the judge. If he'd lead police to the body in the desert, he'd get his sentence reviewed. So in 1968, he took the detectives out into the desert, showed them the grave, and then he went free. Then by 1969, he was back in Rome, shooting the wrong Doyle. But the story about the shooting at Grace's place, something about it's always felt kind of off to me. I mean, to be fair, Gene Bird had never needed much motive to kill. He was intelligent and had a knack for getting away with murder, but he was also kind of indiscriminate. His daughter told me that it wasn't just the guy in the desert he'd killed out in California. He'd stabbed a guy to death in a motorcycle shop as well. And after the shooting in Gary and Grace's bar, he went to prison, but within a year, a judge had ordered him released, and then he'd go on to kill someone else in South Georgia somewhere before later being killed himself. But still, why would Gene Bird want to kill Doyle Wade? Grace had left Doyle. She was with Gary now, and Gene Bird knew that. I mean, that's why Gary and Grace had the bar together. Grace didn't want Doyle Wade. He was a problem in her life, a nuisance at best and sometimes a threat. When Gary wasn't at the bar, she'd have to have one of her brothers or someone else come and be there with her, just in case Doyle Wade showed up. Which is why I still can't understand Gene Bird's motivations that night.
After the thing happened, he said he's after Grace. He was after Grace.
Well, but, like, was he doing it? Was he clearing the field, or was he trying to please her?
I don't know. The way Gene told me, he was wanting Grace and was trying to get with Grace.
So why kill the ex?
I don't know. I'm telling you, the man came in that beer joint, is calm. There was no rage or anything.
Whatever voice of rage and ruin motivated Gene Bird to shoot Doyle that night, it wasn't events like that that were the problem in Grace and Gary's relationship. When it came to preparing for a shootout, they were strong together. That foundation was solid. But after they were out of the beer joints, after the danger had cleared, things would fall apart between them. I think it was because the danger had cleared that things would fall apart between them. After all, Bonnie and Clyde isn't a story that's going to end happily ever after.
When we got out of Rome, and I got away from the wild beer joints and the shootouts and the cuttings and the fightings and all the wild stuff. And I got to Atlanta, and I got into, I got a job there at the liquor store, and I got into a different type of people. I mean, it was we had Emory students that come there. It was a different life. And man, I enjoyed that life. And I built up making pretty good money, was taking care of the kids. But Grace would only stay for so long, and then she had to get back to that life. She would leave everything and go back to the beer joints. And then after a while, we'd hook back up. There was something there with her I don't want to speak bad of the dead, but she could only live that kind of life for so long, and then she had to get back to that.
Later, in a different conversation, Gary told me this again, that the dangerous life had kept calling Grace back in. But then he added, and it was calling me too, after all, I somehow ended up back there. And when Gary returned to Rome, the old dangers were still there waiting, ready to be picked up from where he'd left them off.
Well, I had two people tell me that Doyle was planning to kill me that night.
I know Doyle Wade come in that bar and told my mama that he loved her and that he would never give her up. I know he come in that bar and said that, and that she would never be with nobody else. And I took that against you.
If you want to check out case materials, photos, transcripts, and court records related to Episode 2 of Undisclosed, The State vs. Gary Mitchum Reeves, don't forget to visit our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. And if you have questions about the case or want to talk about the episode, join in the discussion online at our Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and other social media accounts. Special thanks for this episode go out to Lisa Harris with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation for her help in tracking down old case files, and to Meethal Telhan for her work in making this show happen, as well as to Naja Bhatti. I'll be back next week with Episode 3, but meanwhile, if you've missed hearing from Rabia, you should check out her interview on this week's episode of the Slate podcast, Mom and Dad Are Fighting, co-hosted by our own sound editor, Rebecca Lavoie.